Welcome to Behind the DM Screen for November of 2023. I think I got all those facts right. We are three DMs talking about our games and helping each other out. And with me, as always, is Mike Shea.
Hello.
Except that, of course, Mike Shea isn't with us always because he's missed the last 2 months.
Yeah, crazy times.
And also with us is Ismael Alvarez.
Hello.
Ismael is also not usually with us, but Sam had to be out, which means I'm recording with completely different people than I've recorded with in the last, what, couple months. Unless Ish, did you sub in? I was going to talk about how, like, I've only played one session in the last month, but, like, for you all, that's new information.
Yeah, so, it's all brand new.
So, but it is not my turn to go first. It's Sam's turn to go first, which means it's Ish's turn to go first. So you can jump right in whenever you're ready.
Yeah, most certainly. So I can't remember the last time I was on, so I'm sure that I'm going to be kind of, throwing a bunch of new information at y'all. I was talking a little bit before we started recording about how I now have a D&D class. So we started this school year doing an elective class at the end of the day that is required. So we have students going into those, and we cycle them through the quarters. And now that we're into quarter two, they've given me this class. And, long story short, I have a pretty dedicated group of students. I thought that I was going to get a bunch of people who are like, this is dumb, I hate D&D, but they've actually gotten into it pretty well. We started by painting minis, which I didn't think the students would get into, and they loved it. So some of them look great. Some of the students really put a lot of care and attention. Some of them look like, basically they use three colors to paint these minis and just, put them everywhere. But a lot of fun was had. And we did the Dungeons and Dragons. It's not the dungeon board game, but it's the Dungeon Adventures board game.
Like the Adventure System? One of those games?
Yeah. It's the weird ones where it's like they have the little tracks that you kind of fit together like puzzle pieces.
Yeah, like Legend of Drizzt and yeah. Wrath of Ashardalon.
No, simpler than that. Gosh, I wish I knew the name of it. But it's just really simplified, like, you're going on an adventure and, like, you have enemy cards. And then you have, like, adventure cards, and the adventure card might be like, you find a lost dog, what do you do? And it's really silly. But anyways, that board game was a great setup because it kind of got them into the mindset. And just this week, we started actually playing actual D&D. I got them set up with characters in D&D Beyond. And again, I thought that they would be resistant to it or that they would think it was boring. But just today, I had the revelation that I needed to make it West Marches because my student roster changes daily, which is frustrating. But I just needed to make it to be where they could do anything in any configuration. So I actually picked up a 10dicepaper.com. It's like a free resource that lets you just generate a West Marches grid, like hex map. Printed that out, and we hit the ground running, and they're in a dungeon right now.
You were talking about that on the Discord today. That was the topic of conversation.
Yes. And so again, just so many things surprised me where I was like, well, we're going to have to do things like track food and make sure that you're ready for inclement weather and make sure you get, like, a cart and horse to pull everything. And they were like really into it. They're like, yeah, okay, we're going to do this and we're going to get this much food. And okay, you do this and you do that. So it's been going really well. And I'll probably talk on the Discord about how that goes as things develop, but it's been a gem. Like, I've been really happy. So there's that. I don't have much more to report on that, except that it's been super cool. And
Age again? You're in a middle school, right?
High school. So it's a bunch of high school students. And it's a range of, like, basically kids from 15 to 19. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's, again, I'm just kind of shocked at how, like, they have kind of collaborated around the table. It's kind of starting to sound like maybe some friendships are striking up. And the great thing about that is that I kind of pitched it as, you know, is it just like a cool elective that kids can have fun and get credit? Yes. But also it teaches kids a lot about like collaboration, organization, about like, you know, problem solving and getting along with each other. And so my hope, and so far it's been working out, is that I'll have a lot to show for it at the end of just showing like, hey, these are kids who probably would never have hung out together and they're doing all of these great things.
That's awesome. And then there's your other 6.5 games.
Right. Oh, I haven't really prefaced this well enough, but yeah, I have 7.5 games. The half is I run a game every other Sunday. And we'll get to that. My Tuesday werewolf game is going great. The players are like, we do what every white wolf game does, and we play like our area. And so they're running around Colorado and trying to stop some conspiracy from like some ancient creatures, and they're not really sure of what all of that is going on. But it's really fun just having a bunch of people who are more used to D&D kind of doing a little bit more of a story-oriented campaign, and knowing that, you know, if you've gotten to combat, it's because you made a lot of bad decisions, generally speaking, or a lot of good ones. But my werewolf game is going really well. We just introduced a new player, and it's really fun because what I did was I set it in 2019, intentionally leading up towards the pandemic. So it's like pre-pandemic, and people are having some fun feeling nostalgic about the old times. And then eventually I'm going to be like, oh, in addition to all of these like world ending monsters that are boiling up out of the ground, also there's a huge pandemic of COVID coming around.
Is there any chance that they will discover that these ancient creatures from, you know, the ruins under the earth were the cause of the pandemic? It was like an ancient virus that was released.
I mean, if things go well, I'm going to make it so it's like your group caused COVID, and then they can feel really bad about it.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
But we haven't gotten there yet. They're just dealing with all of the world crises one week at a time, and so we're inching towards 2020. But I'll report on that when it happens. The funny thing about my Tuesday game is that we have the breakout character that's actually a werecoyote. But he's like the biggest disaster of a werewolf werecoyote that you've ever met. And the shenanigans revolve around him just being a horrible person, but then a really good werecoyote. And it's just really funny. So a lot of nomenclature has come up around Tony Pacheco, who's the breakout character of the game. But yeah, it's been a blast getting back into World of Darkness and just kind of getting people used to the rule system for that. And I'm actually using new World of Darkness rules, but old World of Darkness setting, which is actually my preference. But it's confusing as all get out. I don't think I'd do it again exactly this way if I had my druthers, but we'll see. My Wednesday game, I actually play a solo game of D&D with my girlfriend, and that's been going great. I know a lot of people ask for advice on like how to run a solo game, but it tends to go pretty good. You just have to pepper in some sidekicks, but we're playing in the Palladium Fantasy setting, but again, 5th edition. And I always love mixing that peanut butter and chocolate of like this game system with this setting, and it tends to work out pretty good.
One of the first things I did when I started playing around with ChatGPT was asking it questions like, hey, what if I wanted to run a game of Blades in the Dark, but it was in the Torg Eternity setting? What would that look like? How would I modify it? And it came up with some really cool stuff. So
I'm always shocked by how ChatGPT is really good at answering questions like that. And I don't know if it's that nerds like us have been teaching it. I have a feeling that that's exactly what's happened. And so it's answered so many of those questions that it's like, no, I've got you. There's like 18 different articles. I'm going to just summon them up for you right now. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to come up with like 12 new ideas for how you could make that happen. And yeah, ChatGPT has been kind of phenomenal for that.
It's not quite so much that we've been teaching it as it's been coming and taking our stuff.
Well,
I didn't. You know,
you're not wrong.
Yeah, they didn't exactly come to me and say, hey, we'd like you to teach. It's like, no, they ransacked my house.
Well, you're not wrong.
It's the part of your house that you put on the outside. Right. I mean, they're ransacking
your dog.
And all
I say is, hey, if you're going to take this stuff from my house, you need to attribute it to me.
Uh-huh.
And they don't do that.
And they don't do that.
Right.
No,
that's correct.
Right.
That's they just took it. Right. Anyway.
Yeah.
I use it every day.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I am both like, hey, I use it. And I'm also aware of the fact that they built a big giant building on stolen ground.
Right.
And
I haven't found a situation yet with, like, I ran an entire adventure in my campaign that was based on an extended conversation I had with the AI. Right. But it didn't write the adventure. Like, there was a lot of work I still had to do as a DM. It just gave me some ideas and some seeds, you know?
Sure. Yeah. So it's a well-read, well-designed random table.
It's kind of like if I need to, like, the kind of thing I would do here. Like, I'm in a situation, I'm prepping for the game. I need to just bounce ideas off of somebody, but I don't have anybody I can pester for an hour or two.
Right.
That's where ChatGPT is helpful for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Going back a little ways, I think that hex map generator probably has some tie to some AI thing. Because it came up with everything. It was like, you know, here's who is in charge of this region. And it is a hard-hearted female cleric who is true neutral and has these goals in mind. And I'm sure that all of these were just like, somehow or another, they were some kind of a chat GPT or guys.
There have been algorithmic random generators for decades,
sure.
Right? And ultimately, that's what ChatGPT is, as I understand it, is it's really, really complex algorithm scrapes data from a lot more sources.
Yep.
It's like I used to remember that kind of thing existed for like universities to play with. And now I think that's finally kind of been democratized. But really, it's just weaponizing plagiarism. But, where we are as a society in the year of our Lord 2023.
Yeah, it's a strange time.
Yes. But my Wednesday game is going great. And it's really fun just kind of doing very similar of just like tracking the travel. And the most recent session has been like, oh, you run into a just a horde of zombie dwarves, and they're still walking in formation because they have enough of their like memory and life that they're just kind of still following the most recent thing that their brains told them to do. And my girlfriend was so misty eyed. She's like, oh my God, that's so sad. And I'm like, that wasn't my intention, but it's, you know, it's good that I evoked that emotion or whatever, but that was fun. My Thursday games, which we had to cancel tonight because we didn't have enough people to play, have also similarly been going really well. So that's my Eberron game. That's kind of my flagship game. They pay me to run that game. And so I try and put a little bit more time and attention to it. But the Eberron game in particular has been hitting this crescendo. I kind of took a page out of your book, Jeff, and like included bunch of cultists trying to bring forward a bunch of like disparate gods. Like they're trying to bring Mishka the Wolf Spider into Eberron. They're trying to bring a Boxob. They're trying to bring Pazuzu. And so the most recent development is that there's like one super evil guy that I've been trying to convince this group that he's the main villain. But every few sessions are like, who is it again? It's what? What's his name? And so I'm like, I don't know what to do. I like he's killed all of these people and he's like caused you all like no end of grief, but you can't remember Zio. It's three letters. But they're finally learning that he has pissed off all of the cultists. So even the cultists who are like, we want to summon Pazuzu, we want to summon Mishka, they have abandoned him because he has used and abused their alliance. And so now they're trying to figure out if they want to ally with these cultists, if they want to exploit this weakness and kind of do that. And then all of this culminated in this like massive four game kind of following of. So this big four session kind of like a giant a plot that they had set out that they were going to set an ambush at an auction and then use the information they get there to like go and confront like the big evil cult that follows the big bad guy. And they did. They passed it with flying colors. I have one player who built his entire character around kind of being a power broker in Sharn, and he got to really shine that day and just used all of his connections to pull everything together. So that was a lot of fun. I feel like for what it's worth, that one player really understands like that Eberron isn't about necessarily about like being a D&D player. It's about being a D&D player in like this, you know, proto-industrial world, and so they really kind of dig into that aspect of it. But it's my second full Eberron campaign so far, and I'm loving it. And it's been timely because Keith Baker has been putting out a bunch of like, as always, like he's always articles that just so happen to coincide with like, oh, I needed to know this about Eberron, and nobody's known this for like the 20 years that, or close to 20 years that Eberron has been in existence, but all of a sudden now this one fact helps me run my game, and it's been just serendipitous. I'm just going to kind of put a cap on everything else. There's my Friday game, which we just finished the Call of the Netherdeep, the Critical Role campaign that they put out recently, and I went off of the rails, and I sent the campaign ended with me sending everyone to the weird red moon, and just being like, okay, if we ever revisit this, the next campaign with these characters is going to be, you're going to have to fight like god eating monsters on the moon, and they were all jazzed about that. But now we're going to run a horror campaign kind of in the style of Curse of Strahd, but in a completely different setting. And then my Saturday game, which I had to move to Sundays, is the Savage Worlds Rifts, which I've been having a blast. I've actually been recording that as a podcast and releasing that. And then I have another 5th edition D&D game that is set in the Palladium Fantasy setting. That's my every other week game. That one's been on a super big hiatus. That's the one where like two of my players went to Australia for a month, so we're going to have to wait to play in December. And that's my time. Unless you have any questions about any of that.
That's a lot. I do have one question. One of the things that is sort of a core thing about Eberron is that the gods are more ambiguous, right? They're not, you know, a physical presence. But cultists trying to bring new gods into the world kind of runs counter to that. Is there the fact that it's happening with multiple cultists, with multiple other gods, is that indicative of something going on in the world that you've thought of? Or is it just, you know, doing something interesting and you'll figure it out later?
Yeah, so with that campaign, I'm building on the bones of my first Eberron campaign. And that one was this like weird confluence of a different set of cultists trying to merge Zoriat with Eberron. And so that, and then at the end of that campaign, it was like, it was all the Yellow King. The Yellow King was trying to like become reborn into the body of one of like the demon overlords. And they had to actually kill that demon overlord, prevent him from becoming the Yellow King. And it was this whole thing. So it really threw Eberron out of whack. And now this group of players is having to deal with the consequences of that. And what they're learning is, the gods that are trying to be summoned in, like Pazuzu and Abaxab, don't want to be in Eberron. They're like, actually, we're kind of cool where we're at. And they're telling their followers, you're being manipulated by this one guy, Izayo. And so now they're like, okay, cool. We love and respect you because we're your cultists. We're going to now turn on this guy. Mm-hmm. And they're still worshiping those beings. In fact, the Pazuzu worshippers were the first ones to kind of be like, no, we're not following this guy. And kind of being like this weird neutral force in the world of being like, we worship Pazuzu and we do a bunch of evil things, but also we want to be left alone. And so that was the turning point for the campaign where the players are like, we've been cult busting this entire time and maybe we've been led astray. Maybe we should not have been cult busting because that's too much work. And clearly these cults are not what we thought they were. And so it's been kind of an interesting thing, but you're completely right. Like these players don't know Eberron well enough to know like that that's not the natural order of things. But I feel like I've at least kind of seeded the ideas that like all of these things are wrong and you should know that they're wrong as like a citizen of this setting or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a part of me that when you were describing it originally, I was like, oh, so there's all these different cultists. They're all trying to bring in these different gods. And the guy who's kind of manipulating them to do it is that they also dislike, you know, and I'm thinking there's, wouldn't it be interesting if there was some grand manipulator that, you know, is benefiting from this, like an Asmodeus or a Vecna style character who's, you know, who benefits from all this turmoil and all this chaos and trying to bring gods into this world that don't want to be there. And what does that mean? And I don't know how Vecna or Asmodeus or whatever would benefit from that, but they're the exact sort of characters that it's like, you play them like Palpatine, regardless of what the players do. It all went exactly the way they wanted it, you know?
Right. So. I haven't really thought about that, so I guess I'd be lying if I said, oh, that's great, and I could integrate it to my campaign. I'd probably have to change a few things.
Sure.
But let's just play a little thought experiment. If Asmodeus was going to be the mastermind behind all of this, he could basically be looking at Eberron as this kind of like cosmic waste bin and saying, These entities like Pazuzu and Abaxab, I don't want them in my reality, and I need to shunt them somewhere where they're going to be contained, because Eberron has always been this kind of like, you know, isolated, separate demiplane that is hard to get into or out of. And so that could be his, you know, nature of wanting to be like, they are disorder. I like order. I'm going to, you know, like the Swedish chef, bork, bork, bork.
Or it could be that there's something in the draconic prophecy that he realizes, oh, if I can manipulate things the right way, then I can work something out to benefit me or you know, condemn right. The entire planet into hell or whatever it is, you know. I don't know.
But really the truth is, and hopefully none of my players are watching or will watch, but I'll trust that they won't. The truth is that this evil mastermind, Zio, is basically a Frankenstein in the Mary Shelley sense, and that he was some kind of an experiment during the last war where they were trying to make him like this conduit of Mabarian energy. So he's like this super undead guy, but he survived the experiment and wants to get revenge on all of the people who experimented on him. And they're all now like super powerful people. So they're like the mayor of Sharn and people who are high up in these agencies. And so he's been getting basically manipulating the group to go fight all these cultists. While meanwhile, he's assassinating all of these important people unbothered because there's no like power group to stop him. And they just learn that more or less.
Evil D&D Captain America.
Yes. Or, I mean, he's more like Winter Soldier, really.
I suppose, yeah.
But I didn't think about that, but that's a great analogy.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mike, you got any questions?
No.
All right.
Sorry, I was way over my time.
No, we always
go over on time.
Way over our time. So that's fine. All right. Before we move on to the next person, I want to remind folks that if you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/thetomeshow. Contribute as little as $1 a month, and that helps me to pay the bills and keep the show going and doing the things that we do. So, all right. I'm going to put another 15 minutes on the clock to ignore so that I can share about my game. Like I said at the beginning, like I got two new people here that haven't been here to hear me talk about where my game's at and what's been going on. But I've only had one session since the last time I recorded. So for the listeners, it would get a little repetitive. But just to catch you all up, I think the last time Mike was on, my group was in the Crypt of the Hellriders. They finished the Crypt of the Hellriders. It was... we spent half a session with them trying to figure out how to free the souls in the crypt. And the trick is you have to like, you find the secret ritual rooms and it has little slips of papers with all the Hellriders names on it. And you have to burn the papers or destroy the papers. And that lowers the protection on the stele. And then you have to like, you know, just chisel the names off of the big rocks and that frees their souls. Right. But they burned all of the names that they found in the first room. And then they got to the second room and found more of the names. And they're like, oh, but what if we need to have these to figure out the puzzle? And so they didn't destroy them. And then they decided, okay, now it's time to go. And they spent literally, it was 2 hours at least, trying to figure out how to destroy this thing. And I was giving them all kinds of clues and hints about, like, you have to destroy the, you have to remove each Hell Rider's name twice. And they didn't pick up, like, and eventually it was like, okay, after 2 hours, and clearly they were, like, frustrated, and I was just getting bored. I'm like, so how long are you going to spend doing this? Well, we're going to keep working on it until we figure it out. Okay, so let's just say you do this for another hour or so, and then you figure it out. Let's move on. So I just sort of hand-waved it and moved on, because nobody was having fun with it at that point, but they were a dog with a bone. They were not going to let that go. But I don't know if you were here, Mike, last time, the last time I talked about what happened at the Crypt of the Hellriders. Before they did all of that, they went outside of the crypt where they were greeted by one of the character's brothers, who is a dragonborn who works with Archon.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a family connection. Like, Archon is their, like, great, great, great uncle or whatever. And so his name is Danlew. Danlew shows up on the back of a big black dragon. And then next to him is Bitter Breath, the horn devil, that every time he speaks, it just billows smoke, and he's lost his wings or whatever, because Ariel cursed him. He used to be a pit fiend and what have you. And he's secretly, like, working for Bell and whatever. But now they've already defeated him a couple times. And so that's no longer a secret. He's just straight up working for Bell now. He's no longer really doing the warlord thing, but he's there too. And with a bunch of, I don't know, spine devils or something weak. And they looked at the situation. I honestly thought it was going to be like, this is it. We're going to have the big drag out fight here, where they're going to finally defeat Bitter Breath. They're going to finally defeat the brother, Danlew. It's going to be this big, massive fight. And they looked at the situation and said, wait, both of them and a dragon? Nah, let's negotiate.
Right. Time for a conversation.
Right. And the reason they were there was to offer a deal. Like, Bell and Archon have sort of struck a tentative alliance. They both kind of want to see Zeriel out because Zeriel's too good at keeping Tiamat trapped, and Bell has made an arrangement with them. And as a sign of good faith, they both decided, let's deal with this group of heroes that keep making trouble all over the place. And so they showed up and they're like, well, we're happy to fight, but we're technically here to offer you a contract. And this party has been so averse to even considering any infernal contracts. Like, as soon as anybody offers one, even though it's like a part of Descent into Avernus, right? The offering of infernal contracts, it's a whole section on it. They absolutely would not consider single one.
They don't care what's in the book.
Yeah, no.
They don't care what the focus is. They're not making a deal with the devil.
Right. They have no interest in making any deals with any devils. And then all of a sudden with this one, they're like, wait a minute, maybe. Because Bell and Archon are offering them a deal. Like, we will stay out of your hair. You don't directly interfere with any of our plots knowingly. We don't knowingly and directly interfere with any of your plots. And as a result, we'll help you with this, and we'll return to you anything that has ever been in our possession, or that is in our possession, that has ever belonged to you as PCs. They've picked up some family heirlooms and stuff along the way that they've stolen from the PCs or taken as a sign of good faith, and then the party walked away. And so that ended up being and they, like, I really don't want to do it, but I don't know that we have another option. We don't want to do this fight. But I also don't want to, do the sign up for this thing. If anybody breaks the contract, we have to promise them four souls. It doesn't technically say our souls, and they're like, is that going to be it out? A loophole? I don't know. Two of us are priests of the Raven Queen, who probably wouldn't be kind to the idea of putting souls in places they're not supposed to go. One of the Raven Queen followers did an augury and asked the Raven Queen, the wheel woe on this whole thing. And from the Raven Queen's perspective, it's like, yeah, that's fine. Go for that. That all sounds like Wheel to me. They're going to help you take down Zeriel, put things to right in hell, find a new balance, return these souls, these Hellrider souls, back to where they're supposed to be. This all sounds like a benefit to the Raven Queen. And as soon as that happened, suddenly 50% of the party is like, all right, I sign it. I'm on board. The Raven Queen gave the thumbs up. So they just had to convince one player who just absolutely was like, no, we can't do it. We can't. But everybody else is like, sorry, you're part of the group. Being part of the group right now means you sign this contract.
Isn't it funny how randomly a game session will turn into 12 angry men just at the drop of a
hat? Right. Absolutely. So that happened. And it actually brings me to one of the questions that I have and I wanted to ask. Since I haven't played much, I came up with a bunch of questions to potentially ask. And this one has to deal with the fact that part of this contract is they agree not to interfere with or directly attack Archon for a year and a day. Right. But the two Raven Queen followers are part of an Assassin's Guild and take their contracts very, very seriously. And one of their contracts from the Assassin's Guild organization or whatever is to kill Archon. Like, Archon is the only person left on this contract and they have to kill him. So they both have a contract that says we have to kill Archon, and also have a contract that says we can't attack Archon.
Have to kill him have a time period?
It doesn't, but that actually brings me to my other issue.
There you go.
It brings me to my other issue, though, of I think it would be dissatisfying or unsatisfying for them for that to happen as an epilogue off camera. Like, the killing of Archon is...
So you don't have to, right? You could have that flash forward of, sure. Wait till the other things in the campaign are done, and says, 1 year and 1 day later, right. And then they show up at the front door of the tower, like, come on out here!
We could, but it brings up my other issue, is that...
That would be fun. And you could have a level jump... Right. So they did some stuff, and what weird scar do you have that you acquired the year and a day where you've been waiting for this?
Well, maybe that's,
I love those jumps.
Maybe that's advice I could do on the other question I had related to that is, the campaign of Descent into Avernus has to deal with saving Elturel, and doing that generally probably involves either destroying or redeeming Zeriel. But I've been sort of layering in these other things that are kind of going on too. For example, it's not an angel inside the companion, the big second sun over Elturel. It's actually Kaz the Destroyer. And he wants to be set free, and he wants to be set free in hell because he knows that's where the Hand of Vecna is, and he wants to go whole hog on Archon. And maybe that's how they fulfill the contract. They let Kaz go, and Kaz goes and it up. Who knows?
Right.
But so there's this whole hinted at, occasionally mentioned Vecna subplot going on. And part of me was layering some of that in, thinking, well, when we conclude the campaign as written, do I want something to sort of go on to extend it a little bit more? And sort of like when I ran my Waterdeep Dragon Heist and Curse of Strahd game, and then you get to the end of Curse of Strahd, and it's like, well, that's not... You didn't have an impact on the world, right? You just sort of got home. And that's not particularly satisfying. So I had this whole other third act that I added. I have laid in seeds. I don't have any plans. And that's part of my issue. I've laid in plans
or seeds are great, man.
For Vecna to possibly be a thing. But do I just allow that to be part of the epilogue? Do I allow that to be part of a future campaign? Because I layered in hints in the last campaign about things that would happen in this campaign too. Do I really want to run a whole third act? Because I've got to tell you, I've already written up 2 pages of potential next campaigns. We're at the point in this campaign that I'm starting to think about the next thing.
I have an idea that just popped into my head. So this Assassin's Guild had a job to kill Archon. What if the person who called that job in was Vecna?
Oh.
Because he wants his hand back.
In theory, does Vecna... I imagine Vecna and the Raven Queen don't get along well because she doesn't like undead, right?
Yeah, they would be like polar opposites.
And the Assassin's Guild are specifically a guild of Shadar Kai in service to the Raven Queen. So that would be tricksy to negotiate. Although
sure. It
would also be totally in, like I mentioned before, Vecna is sort of the Palpatine, regardless of what happens. He manipulated it and he wins. It could very well be that he manipulated even the Raven Queen into making this happen.
But that could also just be another interesting kind of wrinkle, because then maybe they find out, no, it's Vecna who asked for you to do that job. Mm-hmm. And so they have to then ask themselves, like, is it valid? Do we follow through because we're people of our word? And, you know, is this in compliance with the Raven Queen? So maybe that's going to be another thing to make them like wonder about whether or not they want to go through with that. But it totally sounds like a way to bring Vecna in, of just being like, no, I was the one that did that. And maybe they learn before, maybe they learn after. But if they learn after, then maybe they're like, oh, we were tricked and we need to do something about this. And we need to, like, you know, get revenge on Vecna for manipulating the Raven Queen or whatever.
Well, the story as they know it is that Kaz is actually, as they've discovered it, is that Kaz is the one who actually was the impetus behind the contract.
Oh, okay.
But it wouldn't be the first time that Vecna manipulated Kaz either, so.
Right.
Okay, interesting. Mike, do you have thoughts?
I would worry about what's in front of you and let the rest of it come out as you play. Right? Like, you know, if it feels right to drop things in later, then you can kind of worry about it later. But I, you know me, worry about your next session.
No, absolutely. I like to worry about my next session, but I also like to layer in, like, hints and
sure, you want seeds and stuff like that. Yeah, but like life has seeds sometimes that don't come out to play.
Sure.
So well, and you can lay those seeds out. And it's fun, I think, to play in a campaign where you have these kind of other seeds about, like, hey, there's four other arch villains and you don't get to them. And like everyone in their head gets to build their, like, what was the Clone Wars story for 30 years, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of, it's fun to leave those open connections.
Well,
and you can always say, like, and one day we'll do that. We're never going to do it. But, like, you know.
But you could.
Isn't like next year Vecna's year? Isn't there a whole 2024 Vecna thing going on next year? Do I have that right?
Well, I think that sounds right.
Yeah. So, I mean, all I'm saying is, like, maybe a source book that comes out next year that you might want to use. So you don't want to blow your Vecna now.
There's
a whole big Vecna adventure.
Who knows? Depending on how the campaign unfolds. We might still be playing at that point.
Might still be playing next year. Yeah. And then you got another book to go on.
So
I mean, think about it's always good to think about the seeds, but even the seeds, it's like, well, what are they going to do next? Right.
Right.
Like, what do we have? What are we doing in our next session? And what seeds do I need to plant for the one after that?
Right.
And then, you know, worry about that later. Well, right? Worry about everything else later.
And I very intentionally, in my last campaign with the same players, so I set this precedent, I layered in a bunch of seeds in the last campaign, knowing that they weren't going to play out.
Yeah.
They weren't going to play out until this campaign, right? And so it could very well be stuff that, you know, for all they know, I did it on purpose to layer in for the next. There was, did you play Dragon Heist?
Yeah.
So did you use, was it Teos that wrote Blue Alley?
No, that was Empty Black.
Oh, Empty Black. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever play Blue Alley then?
Yep.
So the thing in Blue Alley is you're trying to recover this unicorn.
Right.
Right? That's been turned into a statue for whatever reason.
Right.
I decided that it's been turned into a statue because it's avoiding an infernal contract that it signed. And that unicorn from that campaign is the unicorn in the Demon Zapper Descent into Avernus.
Yeah, yeah.
I did a bunch of stuff like that, right? So so they did all that stuff at the Crypt of the Hellriders. They then went on. I've been layering in a bunch of the adventures from the organized play season around Descent into Avernus. And so we sort of went to the big finale conclusion. There's like the last, this big dungeon, but of course it's organized play. So they do it as a dungeon in three parts. They're supposed to do it in three sessions. And we basically did it in three sessions. And at the end, like, the big bad got to the person you're trying to rescue first, and they escape with that person, and then there's like follow-up adventures. I don't want to deal with the follow-up adventures. So the big bad was there and did escape with the person you're trying to rescue, but he's just ahead of you. And so they chase him, you know, out of this escape tunnel. They chase him back out into the Canyon of Screams, and he's out there, and he's run into this massive demon that I pulled from Flea Mortals. This big, giant, like, amalgam demon creature is now fighting the General Everbleed, the ice demon, who's trying to run away with the high priest that they're trying to rescue that was a Hell Rider and what have you. And so rather than doing this whole other adventure later where they have to hunt down General Everbleed and deal with all of this, they just got to deal with this one big fight out in the canyon. And I think that'll be a good sort of conclusion. And then we can get back to the actual main part of the campaign, which next up, I made the Canyon of Screams be an offshoot of Costachi's Maw. So they're right there and they're going to do the whole free Costachi thing so that Olanthius will tell them the secret of how to get to the whatever the palace is, the scab and wherever the sword and
all. Yeah, right. The right, exactly.
Bleeding Citadel. Is that what the name?
That sounds something like that.
So
the rotten scab.
And based on the last time I ran Descent into Avernus with my kids, I feel like once they get the sword, and really it's not that many sessions once you get to the Citadel. It's not that many sessions before they get the sword, right? There's a session of sort of going through the scab and then a session of the Idle-Glen stuff. And then they've got the sword. And once you've got the sword, it's kind of a sprint downhill to the end of the campaign. So in theory, you know, I always misjudge this. I always say in theory, we have X number of sessions left and it always ends up being like double that. But in theory, the campaign could be done in like by the end of the year. It'll probably go at least a month after that, I imagine, based on my history of these things. But one of the questions I asked last time that neither of you were here for, and it'd be interesting to get different perspectives on this, was we've been in hell a long time. The Monster Manual only has a handful of demons and devils to fight. And by this point in the campaign, spine devils, bearded devils, these are boring, right? They're not, even chain devils. Okay, we've killed five of them now. Like, they're not surprising. They're not shocking. They're not, you know, the big, bad, scary things that devils are supposed to be. So how do you, what is your advice for spicing up the fact that you're in hell and there's this infinitely sized plane with infinitely sized armies, but it's just more bearded devils and chain devils? What do you think?
It's like the biggest softball you threw me in the world.
I try.
Like what, there's a book.
What Mike Shea product
book
should I
buy? called Forge of Foes.
Huh.
It lets you make all of the devils you would want at any challenge level with a ton of different powers and a ton of different features. I'll tell you my biggest dirty trick is, it isn't five chain devils. It's five individual chain devils with all of their own stories and all of their own mannerisms and all their own looks and all their own motivations. And every one of them can be different and described differently. And you can flavor, you don't even have to change the mechanics. You can flavor their attacks differently. And it feels like a different monster, right? You could just kind of describe how they operate. And like a different monster.
Give me two different ways of describing I hit them with a spike chain.
Sure. It's not a spike chain. One of them is they're made out of bone, right? So they're able to call out and they're surrounded by swirling bones that they whip together into terrible flesh ripping kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. That would be one. Another one, it's all psionic. Right. They're able to create this incredible. They don't look like a chain devil. They just look like a person with a pair of pants on. But then, you know, they open their eyes and like crazy psionic attacks swirl around them and twist and shred at the sanity of their minds. There's two.
Or you could steal from. Have you been watching Gen V on Amazon Prime?
No.
So it's an offshoot of The Boys. But what the main character there has blood-based superpowers.
Right, blood-based powers, right. So you know, all this kind of stuff you can do. So, I think there's one of the most common things, like, how do you make this more interesting? It's like flavor. You make it interesting with flavor, right? You come up with different descriptions. You absorb everything. Watch shows, maybe not The Boys, but watch other shows.
There's
no one to love that show. But I think there's a lot we can do with flavor. But then, beyond that, there's also a million other monster books that have tons of devils in them. You've got MCDM's Flea Mortals, which I hear has the best vampires that have ever been written. You have Tome of Beasts 1, 2, and 3.
For what it's worth, I really liked Flea Mortals, what they did with demons there.
I think they have a whole bunch of devils too, and they're all very pact based.
They have a bunch of devils, but they're all very lawyery and doesn't fit where I'm at in the campaign.
Well, so. I wasn't sure. Yeah. They're not the ones that you would fight, but I think that it's neat that they have that other angle on devils that isn't typical to what you find in every other monster book.
Yeah.
But Kobold Press has a million of them, right? The four mm-hmm. Kobold Press monster books has millions of them. But I think
I also have Green Ronin's Book of Fiends, where Rob Schwab just wrote a giant book.
Yeah, holy cow. Rob Schwab's got you covered.
Yeah.
Right. He's got demons pouring out of every orifice. He's got plenty of them to hand you. The other idea is what about having Yugoloths invade, mm-hmm. right? So, Yugoloth mercenaries start to come in. And you could have this whole thing, maybe there's a whole other plot going on, another invasion, Zariel's too busy fighting demons with all of her devils, and some other group hired an entire mercenary company of Yugoloths to invade hell and raid it for artifacts or assassinate important key figures or all the above. And now you've got a big pile of Yugoloths, and there's, I think, the Monsters of the Multiverse, I think, has bunches of Yugoloths. And the new Planescape book has a bunch of Yugoloths too. Hmm. So there's other forms. I'm not crazy about the mechanics of them, but the storylines for them, if you're looking for ideas for these kinds of things, Monty Cook Games Planebreaker books, has a monster, a bestiary, and that bestiary has tons of weird ass planar creatures that you could probably reflavor and drop in. Keep an eye on the mechanics. I'm not a huge fan of their 5e mechanical design, but with some fixes it works just fine,
right?
And Forge of Foes helps you with those fixes.
Part of the trick is that I have come to really, really like using the encounter builder in
D&D Beyond's Monopoly. You want me to rant about that for a half hour?
You're not going to get any disagreement, but it's a little bit like Amazon, right? It's horrible business, and yet it's so convenient.
It's a little like Amazon. It's very good. Yeah, right.
It's so convenient. But
so a trick there is put in a placeholder, right? So you can still use the encounter builder. You just put in a placeholder, and you have the book sitting next to you.
What I've come to with Flea Mortals, because I kind of want the whole of Flea Mortals in there. So all I do is I just put in the required fields, hit points and all that kind of stuff. And then when it comes to the powers, I just list.
You just look.
I list the book and page number, so I know exactly where to go when I'm running it.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's great.
That's a lot easier to load. Ish.
I do have one suggestion for you, and this is kind of sideways, but I was running a Tiamat campaign, and I didn't want to just throw dragons and wormlings and all of these kind of draconic foes, and I did some of the, what do they call those devils that are also dragons?
The Abishai.
Abishai, thank you. Yeah. So I threw some Abishai, but I didn't want to overwhelm people with that because that kind of gets old if it's just all Abishai all the time. So one of the things that I really liked from kind of going back to Dragonlance, going back to third edition, going back to some of the things they did were they were Tiamat flavored monsters. And so you ended up having it's a rhino, but it's also a blue dragon.
Yeah, right.
It's a velociraptor, but it's also a red dragon and so on. And so what I did then was I just, quote unquote, married a beast with an aspect of a dragon and did a bunch of really wild and crazy things. I think I ended up having the players fight swordfish that were also black dragon tainted. And I had an elephant at one point that was a blue dragon. That was actually a mammoth. That was one of my favorites because I ended up making it a boss fight. It was a mammoth and it was even bigger than it was supposed to be. And it could shoot lightning bolts out of its trunk. And that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, so, I think I think it might be Volo's Guide. When Volo's Guide was out, had a bunch. It's either Volo's Guide or Mordenkainen's, not Tome of Foes. Yeah, Mordenkainen's Tome of Foes. Right, that was the older one to the other one, and it had a bunch of like different planes of hell and the abilities that you could drop on existing monsters to make them like the Avernus version of whatever, which immediately multiplies the number of monsters you have in the monster manual by that feature, right? Like you suddenly have these, so that idea of like add the word infernal, give it a fire shield and run a rhinoceros. And it works great. I think you can go really far with it. Same with undead, right? You can take a whole bunch of undead and make them fiendish and put weird hellish stuff on them.
Cool.
So I think the world's your oyster when it comes to finding fun.
Oh, it definitely is. It definitely is. Yeah. Very good. All right. We should keep moving though, because there's about 30 minutes before I've got a heart out. So we want to make sure we give Mike his time. Before we give Mike his time though, I want to remind people, if you want to find us on social media, The Tome Show is on various social medias. Sometimes it is The Tome Show and sometimes it's just me, Squatch. And I guess I'm there to represent The Tome Show. So come and check us out. Although the place to really be is our Discord. We're big enough that we have constant sort of fun conversations, but small enough that there's not a big signal to noise problem that you see on some of the bigger Discord channels. So come and hang out with us there. And Ish will tell you all about his West Marches game that he's running for the school. So, all right, Mike.
Yo.
15 minutes on the clock that we will agree to go.
So I am going to talk about my Shadowed Keep on the Borderlands game. I got a bunch of different campaigns going on. Shadowed Keep on the Borderlands is an adventure that is written by Raging Swan. It's actually unfortunate because by the time the show happens, it's not there. You should go buy it, but it's a deal of the day right now. So you can get it, while we're recording, it's like $4 and it's totally worthwhile, but it's worthwhile anyway. And it's a black and white product. So you can buy the print on demand copy, which you should buy for very little money on DriveThruRPG. It's a fantastic campaign done by Raging Swan, who makes really, really good system agnostic and 5e based role-playing game material, very old school style, very usable, very flexible. And Shadowkeep on the Borderlands is their homage to Keep of the Borderlands and Village of Hamlet and other kind of these old school adventures, but written in a style that is easier to use and easier to parse and easier to drop into your existing game than I think some of the old adventures were with 40 years of further experience. So I've been running, this was my group had run Spelljammer before. So we did all sort of crazy space stuff. And then I was like, let's do traditional old school, right? And they're all into it. And I started off with like, it's kind of in a Greyhawk setting. That was sort of a mistake. But we mostly just ignore the Greyhawk stuff and stuck to like the locations that you can find in Shadowed Keep and the Dulwich, Dulwich area in the adventure itself. It immediately went off the rails. So even though it's called Shadow of the Keep of the Borderlands, we've been playing 7 or 8 sessions. They have not even, I think they're just now thinking, maybe we'll go to the Shadowed Keep. And instead they've been wandering around these other areas. The plot has focused, I've been very organic with the story, like letting the story go wherever it goes and not worrying about it too much. But the idea was they started finding these ancient black obelisks that were like had been buried under the ground, but now were being unearthed by strange cults. And they were trying to figure out what these things were. And they were getting weird visions when the characters would interact with them. They get like weird visions. They found one right outside of the city of Dulwich, and then learned that there are other ones, and learned that there's this cult known as the followers of the Black Harbinger. And so they're trying like, who's this Black Harbinger they found? And then they see that there's some cults that are fighting other cults. They know that there's like, another weird cult that's underneath the town in the sewers that's murdering people and feeds them like weird mushrooms and gives them strange hallucinations and then kills them. And so there's all this sort of strange different groups that are coming on. And in the last session, they found some goblin cultists of one group that murdered these other human cultists of the other. And discovered that the human cultists that they figured out who the Black Harbinger was, which is Orcus, right? That all along the entity that this group is worshiping is Orcus, who has like 3 or 4 different names, but got picked up and discovered there. So that was really fun. But they know that there's like, the cult of the Black Harbinger is at war with this other cult. Who's that? And then there's a third group that's like telling them about the fact that these two groups. And what the characters don't know is there are two other cults, and both of them are each of the individual heads of Demogorgon who are fighting each other. So my great fun bit is that, you know, I forget the two names of the, you know, I don't have them on hand, but each of the heads, it's like Hezrodiah and Azaloth or something. And one of them is sort of the lawful evil, smart, cunning, calculating one. And the other one is like this chaos murdering one. And the goblin cult was following the chaos murdering one, but the cunning one is the one that feeds people weird mushrooms down in the basement and knows about the other two. So I've always wanted to tell a adventure, share, build a campaign around the idea of warring cults that are both Demogorgon, because I just thought that that would be a good time. And this is my chance to do that. So the main culmination of this thing is that there's a location known as the Black Cathedral, which I stole right out of Twin Peaks with the black, what do they call it? The Black Lodge. Right. And I was like, oh, I like that idea. The Black Lodge. I'm going to do that, but it's going to be the Black Cathedral. And so there's this huge, shining, beautiful cathedral that's in Dulwich that is totally way bigger and way more expensive than any cathedral should be inside of a city of this size. But like all of the guilds keep one-upping each other, trying to pay the other group to make it better and that, you know, have their name, you know, higher in the list. So it's over. But it turns out there is an antithesis of this cathedral that's up above called the Black Cathedral, which is in a big chamber below the town and has been there for like a million years. And only now is getting uncovered by these cults who want to use it as a gateway to bring their demon prince into the world. And it's being like located and empowered by these obelisks that the characters are hunting down. So part of the hard part has been sort of staying just one step ahead of what the players want to do and what the characters are going after without spelling out too many of the details. So like, you know, I'm trying to follow my 3 of 5 quests idea, which is that if you never want to say like, oh, all they have to do is stop one obelisk and then no one will ever find the Black Cathedral, right? Like you want them to find the Black Cathedral, but you also want them to progress in disabling the obelisk. So you say like, ah, it's slowing them down in their ability to open the gateway at the Black Cathedral, but you're still going to have to go down there and deal with it, right? Even though they, you know, Demon Prince would have been here a month ago, except for you meddling kids. And now, you know, they have to show up. So I don't really know what's going. I know that one of the obelisks, I think the last obelisk, they know that there were two other obelisks that they haven't dealt with. One of which is in the basement of the Shadowed Keep, which is known as like Valentine's Folly. And that way they'll actually go and do the adventure that we bought, right? But and then I think, you know, then eventually they're going to go to Black Cathedral. But I have no like idea how long this is going to be. I don't have any outline of sessions. I don't really have like big plans, and I'm just sort of playing it by ear as we go. Literally just, you know, that gif of the train riding down and the guy standing on top of the train who's putting the track in front of it. Right. Like that's exactly what I'm doing here. Right? Yep. It's just barely staying ahead of the story, because there is this is one where like I'm not following a campaign that anybody else wrote. I've got this adventure, but the adventure is really just like, hey, here's an adventure location and some interesting NPCs that are wandering around the town and stuff like that. It's a very loose adventure, and I decided, well, I'm going to let it go off the rails because I think that's a lot of fun. Where it goes, you know, how long we go, I really don't know, but it's been a good time. A lot of use of Dyson logo maps. I've been grabbing lots of Dyson logo maps to fill in locations as they explore these places, and it's been a good time.
And for what it's worth, I have now purchased Shadowkeep in the Borderlands.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a really good. Yeah. It's got lots of cool random tables in it. It's a very, very well designed.
It's not
adventure.
Quite $4. It's like $6, but it's 50% off.
Okay. Not quite $4. Yeah. Yeah. It's got like great random tables in it. It's got a lot, you know, it's a really like, it's so wonderful to find a product where the person who designed it, like knows what GMs need to help them. So an example is like, it's got location descriptions for all of the different places in Dulwich, but it also has a summary page of all of those same locations so that when you're in the game running it, and they're like, I want to go to this place. You don't have to like go through 10 pages of stuff. you can just read that one page summary that's got one line about what's right. going on there. So same thing with like NPCs, you know, same thing with lots of places. And that very brief summary is so handy when you're running it.
When I looked for it, there were like three other versions because it was previously a Pathfinder adventure. And then there yeah. was an updated Pathfinder adventure.
Yeah, I think it's like 10 years old. Right. So I think Crichton, who's the author of it, you know, has been it's a project he has tinkered with numerous times, and it's been run and tested, and feedback has been brought back into it again. So that's really great too, that you're getting a really well tested thing that has lived beyond, which is something with print on demand that you can't do with like published products, right? Like, you know, it's not like we're going to see a new Planescape adventure where after a year's worth of, you know, or Descent into Avernus, right? Wouldn't it be kind of neat if like the person who bought Descent into Avernus a year from now had all of the experiences that we've had with it bundled and passed back in and updated again?
Right.
That's not going to happen.
Well,
but it has happened with this one.
Yeah. It's tricky. Like sometimes I will buy like Kobold Press does a lot of like, let's take our old Pathfinder stuff and convert it to fifth edition. Right.
Sure.
Rob Schwab did it with some of the Shadow of the Demon Lord stuff, for like some spells and whatever. Right.
Yeah. Right. The blasphemies of Borb Wallace.
Right. And those always bring up some really fun options. It's also a little tricky because like every edition of D&D has a different sort of aesthetic. Right.
Yeah, so sure. Different feeling. Does that work? Yeah.
When Kobold Press converts something from Pathfinder to, which let's be honest, that was probably them converting something from third edition to Pathfinder and then Pathfinder right. to fifth edition.
Yeah.
It feels different.
Yeah.
I can make it work. And there's a lot of all of those editions of D&D in fifth edition. So yeah. I can play with those things, but it has a little, like you have to sort of now.
Well, and I think that with Shadowed Keep, for example, you could easily run with a system agnostic version.
Right.
And just fill in the blanks with your, like, you know, it's the kind of product, I just don't need stat blocks.
Right.
Like you don't need to, you know, and if you tell me, hey, they find a magic sword, I can find one.
Right.
You know, so what I'm, yeah, it's interesting to see that. In this case, like I know that, you know, it's more than just, hey, we ported an old adventure to a new system.
Right.
Because, hey, everyone loves the 5e. In this case, it was like it had been run a bunch of times and the stuff that had come back from it being run made its way back into it. And you can tell, you can just see how things got cleaned up in it. And
exactly. And that's what I was going to say is that in a situation like this with an adventure, even I've run Tales of the Old Margrave and a bunch of
yeah,
adventures
right.
and whatever, right?
Right.
And those are all conversions from previous yep. editions. But there's an like if you as a DM are willing to take the story and the descriptions and the settings and the things that have been crafted and detailed and all the help that's been put in and all the handouts that have been added over the years or whatever, but be okay with like if you but be prepared to like I don't like their mechanical take on this.
Sure.
Fine. But you then
reskin
then
it. Yeah.
Be ready to reskin it and run it the way you want to.
Right.
And that works really
yeah.
well. So
yeah.
I look forward
and then,
to checking
right.
it.
I very much am a big believer that reskinning, you know, like you should just do it anyway, right? Like you should be really good at that. Like it's a GM skill that cannot be undersold.
Right. We've been talking about reskinning things since third edition,
right? Right.
But, and yeah. we really talked
and
about it.
And
wait,
we still see people who hang on to the idea, like, oh, I really want, and it's like, don't worry. Like you're going to have to fix it anyway. Like just, yeah. So I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's a fun classic adventure. In my opinion, if I had started over again, I would have done it a little differently. I wouldn't have bothered with Greyhawk stuff. Yet I don't think it's gotten in the way. It's been a good time. It's been lots of fun to drop. Lots of very character focused sub stories. You know, one of the things is two of the characters are elves who kind of ran away from the elven kingdom. And there's a group that, you know, that the king wants them back because they're both need to be married off to rival groups so that they'll, you know, solidify alliances. And they're like, we just want to go be adventurers. And, you know, now they're being hunted by an elven hunter who's like, you know, I'm not going to be the nice guy, right? I'm going to grab you. Actually, he's going to end up killing them. One little trick that I did is my, I don't know if it's a perfect fix, but one of the ways of dealing with drow is that drow are just elves who worship Loth, and you can't look at them and see oh, you're a drow because you have white hair and dark skin, which it's problematic for all kinds of reasons. But like, instead, just like, no, elves can just be drow. Right. And followers of Loth who follow what, you know, how Loth became a god as opposed to other elven gods.
I mean, that's what makes it. You have to change the setting lore to
sure. I don't care. It's my own setting. Right. I'm making up as I'm going. Right. I did this first in Eberron. It actually works pretty well in Eberron.
Sure.
And
in Eberron, there's no particular reason that the drow need to look like that.
Exactly.
Because they're not an underground race.
And then so many other ones. Right. So that works that. And but in here it was one because it actually makes it really fun where they don't realize, oh, the king sent two groups to go get his daughters back. One of them is his ambassador who's going to try to talk them back. Right. And he's like, you know, hey, look, hanging out with these smelly humans is not what you're meant to do. And by the way, you're probably going to get some kind of infection. So you really should just come back with us. You know, you're going to go in the sewers and you're going to get some disease and it's going to be terrible anyway. So why don't you just come back with? And the other one is this assassin who has murdered many other nobles for the other king, but he's actually a drow and nobody knows it. And his thing is like, I'm not going to bring him back. I'm going to murder them. Right. And so that's a fun. They don't know it yet. Right. But it turns out like, oh, no, he's not a good guy either.
No,
he wants instability on purpose.
You had said something about like if you did it again, you may leave out the Greyhawk stuff. Does the adventure assume Greyhawk?
No, it has its own setting. So it has its kind of own proper nouns for all of the locations and stuff. And actually he has, I forget what's called, there's something duchy. And there's another book that expands the area of Shadowed Keep if you wanted a greater area. That was fine, but I don't think I needed it. Like I was happy to have the empty locations and fill it with my own stuff. Okay. And actually using the Greyhawk gods, I think worked fine. It was just a little bit weird to try to shoehorn in Greyhawk locations. I don't actually think it's hurt that much. It's just, it hasn't really added anything.
Okay.
To have the Greyhawk stuff. It's like, well, you need an elven nation and you need, you know, gods and you need some other stuff. So it's as handy as anything.
Would it be easy enough to port into whatever random setting you want to do?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Easily. Right. You just pick a region of the world and drop it in and off you go. Same way like Phandal, you know, nobody had ever heard of freaking Phandalin before.
Right.
And now suddenly Phandalin's in, you know, the center of the world. So
right.
Yeah, it's definitely easy to drop it in.
Right on. Cool. Well, I look forward to checking it out and adding it to my menu of two pages
sure.
of potential yep. next campaigns. So.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
You have anything else? You've only
no,
just
that's it for me.
You've only just gone to your time, so
I'm going to stay to my time.
Wow.
I'm having a great time, yeah.
For once, the most disciplined member of the...
I'll share another thing since you brought it up. I've been running a lot of Shadow Dark, right? So the Shadow Dark RPG by Arcane Library.
Oh, I don't know it.
Oh my God. So they had a $1.4 million Kickstarter and the whole premise of Shadow Dark is old school style with modern sensibilities. So, you know, if you look at a lot of sort of the OSR styles, you get like Old School Essentials, which are fantastic books, right? They're really, really good, but they hang on to some of the old mechanic systems pretty tightly. So you have like your save versus wands and your save versus death and, you know, in descending armor class and descending, you know, Thaco and stuff like that. They have other versions that have ascending. Anyway, Kelsey, a designer who out of Las Vegas, who has been working at Arcane Library, another fantastic set of awesome 5e adventures that you can pick up over in Arcane Library. She grasped this idea and said, I want to make an old school style game, but one that recognizes the fact that there's a lot of nice things in 5e. Mm-hmm. And she developed this book called Shadow Dark. And Kickstarter had run earlier in the year. It did very, very well. Tens of thousands of people, more than $1 million. And the digital version of that has now been out for some time. And my players are interested in it. I was interested in it. So I ran what they call a gauntlet, which is, you know, what if you're familiar with like Dungeon Crawl Classics, they have the same kind of thing where you run zero level characters. You just watch them fall over and die being looked at by anything. And then whoever survives is like the characters that go onward. So I ran a gauntlet to see how that worked. Then my Sunday group, we've been running an actual Honest to God campaign in it called The Gloaming, which is based on one of the zines that Arcane Library published called Cursed Scrolls. They have Cursed Scroll 1, 2, and 3. And I'm using the one from Cursed Scroll 1, which is sort of like haunted forest, you know, haunted European forest kind of idea, but really, really fun. And my players love it. And this past weekend, previous weekend, I ran Ravenloft for Halloween using Shadowdark. And I used the original i6 Ravenloft, that 40-year-old 1983 i6 Ravenloft with Shadowdark. And it was a huge hit. And I must have run Ravenloft more than a dozen times. And I think this is absolutely how I would run it again. Like, it was really, really fun. Very deadly. They had 5 players and 10 characters, and they used every one of them. So, like, they would, every time they died, they'd replace a character. And the my favorite death, my poor friend Paul, in the adventure, it says, like, hey, when you're walking across the bridge, there's a 5% chance a plank on the bridge falls, and you have to make a dexterity save or you fall 1,000 feet. And I rolled a 1d20 for each one to see if the plank broke. He got the 1, the plank broke, he made a dex save, he rolled a 6, and off he went. And his character died before ever making it to the front door of Ravenloft. And then, wow. But then we just handed him another character, right? I had a stack of these 10 NPCs, or 10 characters, and off we went. And it was a great game. So I again, for people who are kind of interested in that old school style of game, we have a character who's second level, it has 2 hit points, and has somehow managed to last 7 sessions. You know, like, it's so, you know, raw. And somebody asked, like, is it bothersome that there's so few character options for these characters? Because they're very, very thin in their mechanics. And I'm like, everyone's too worried about getting killed. No one has time to think about whether they have power attack, right? They're like, you know what would be great? You know it's better in power attack? Not getting hit, right? Because right. If I get hit, I'm probably going to die. So, yeah. So it's been, you know, we had a character who got, like, dropped, and he was at 0, and he's dying. And another character grabbed him and then ran into a shelter and hit a fire trap. And the fire trap killed the character he was carrying. So he's like, I didn't even get. It's like, it wasn't even me. Like, I was trying to be rescued, and in being rescued, I died. So, yeah. So it's a ride. I definitely recommend taking a look at Shadowdark. It is really, really cool. Free quick start rule. So you can go to DriveThruRPG. They have a free first level, 0 and first level characters, and an adventure and a GM's guide and everything. And it's all free to try.
Yep.
And
they've it's fully playable. They've got the quick start on their website as well. And you can buy the books directly from them. And, yep. And Shadowdark RPG is only $30, which is pretty cheap for a game.
And for holy cow. And it just, I love this because, like, it's the kind of game that you're like, I could play this the rest of my, I mean, I don't know if it would last as, like, a campaign for long-term stuff, because it's really, you know, 10 levels are pretty thin. But I know that, like, I could just grab the system and play it once a year forever, right? Mm-hmm. That, like, it's such a solid system, and it's so much fun, and a great Discord server, and she's very approachable with, you know, talking to her about the ideas she's got for things, and it's great. So I love
it. Sweet. All right. Well, you've added a bunch of things to my to look at list. So I'm also intrigued by all the, they've got a bunch of 5e adventures, which I think you had
mentioned. Yes, and they're fantastic. I've bought them and reviewed them. I think they have a bundle. No, I think the bundle holiday ended. Never mind.
They have a bundle of everything that they published from 2017 to 2020, it looks like, for $50.
Which is not, they just had a recent bundle of holding where you could get a big pile of adventures for $10.
Oh, I missed it.
That's over.
Darn. All right. Well, I'll keep an eye out for the next one, huh?
Yeah, great stuff.
All right. Very good. Ish, you got anything for Mike?
No, I'm really excited about the stuff that you've mentioned. And yeah, I wanted to run a Ravenloft Halloween game, and I think you've inspired me. I'm going to do it next year.
Yo, it's so great. Yeah. I don't know if I told you my trick, that it's like you just let them loose in the castle to go find the items. You do the card roll, and Strahd shows up at 3.5 hours. So, you know, the session's ending. Right. Like, it's just a hard timer, and you let them know, and you're like, you know, and they're like, we got 5 minutes before Strahd shows up. So it works really, really well.
Oh, so they know that they have 3.5 hours.
They know how long they have, because Strahd's like, you can be run free and I'll see you guys in 3.5 hours.
Okay.
Yeah. And in my game on one, they actually ran right to him, and because he's located in one of the rooms. Right. And they went right to him, and he started just kicking their ass, and they had to run. Geez. Like, oh, my God. And then later, like, we don't want to see that guy again.
If they get the items, do they have a chance to beat him?
They got the Sun Sword. Yeah, okay. they only got one, but they got the Sun Sword, and that helped them. They did defeat him.
Okay.
He did charm a guy, so they got the Sun Sword, hit him a couple of times. He then charmed the person, had them throw it off a cliff. Like, get rid of that thing. And then one of my friends was like, that happened last year too. It's a good technique, right? Yeah. Like, get rid of that thing. It charms you, gets you to throw the thing away. That's causing him all this grief.
I used to run. I used to have a tradition of running the I-9. I have the old original I-9 Ravenloft, and I ran it every single year at around Halloween time.
Yeah,
you know, for one or two sessions. But then I would track what happened in one session, and then
feed it in
the changes of the world. You know, oh, they knocked over a bunch of statues one year. Well, the next year those statues are back upright again, but they're all cracked and beaten up. You know.
Yeah, my favorite thing to do to shake things up was change the protagonist, the antagonist, and the seer. And so one year they did it, and they got into the carriage, and there's this hooded figure, and he's doing the cards, and he pulls his mask back, and it's old Strahd. And he dies immediately, and they're like, oh man, that was Strahd. And it's like, yep, and guess what? Irina's the vampire that you have to beat. She took over for Strahd 10 centuries ago.
Right.
And you know, her brother is the one that you have to rescue. So it's like you change the, you know, who's the villain, you know, who's the person that needs to be rescued? Who's the villain? What if it's Madame Eva who's the villain? Right. So I have like a list of like, here's 10 possible villains for Curse of Strahd. The rest of it runs exactly the same, only you get this new flavor.
Right.
You know, new flavor every time. Lots of fun. Yeah.
Good times. Good times. All right. Very good. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Ish. We're going to go ahead and call that the end of our episode of Behind the DM Screen. Go to thetomeshow.com to check out this and other great Tome Show shows. And Mike and Ish, do you want to say anything about where people can go to see you?
Yeah, so I'm on Mastodon now.
Yay!
I am on Twitter for as long as, or X, I guess now, as long as it lasts as on Wizard King. Exactly. I'm not happy. but yeah, I'm also on DriveThruRPG as my namesake, Ismael Alvarez, and you can find me there. I write a lot of stuff for Fat Goblin Games. And yeah, that's more or less it.
Right on. I'm as active on Twitter now as I have been for the last 5 years, which means I log in once every couple of days and I don't really post anything.
I marked mine private.
Good.
I'm done. I'm on Mastodon, but I don't really care. SlyFlourish.com is where you find all my stuff.
You. You're not on Blue Sky?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Who cares? I don't know. Yeah, don't get me on. Like, why? Like, oh, God, I was terrible. Like, what happened on Twitter? We should all do that again over on Blue Sky.
Right. Well, like, but that's not any different than Mastodon.
It is. Mastodon is individual servers. I know the guy. I can email the dude who's running my Mastodon server right now and talk to him.
Okay.
He's a friend
of mine. My experience is identical.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Totally different. There is no billionaire sitting on top of Mastodon who's deciding how they're going to harvest all your
on Blue Sky?
Sell it. Yes. Oh, it's freaking owned by the freaking guy who made Twitter.
I didn't know that.
What's his name? Yeah. They can't wait to harvest all your crap. It is supposed to be like an open platform and all that. And maybe if they ever distribute it and ever turns into an open platform, that would be great. But right now it's another billionaire with an idea that he's trying to save the world.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's call
Sorry for the politics.
Let's get off of our, it's not really political, but let's get off of our
technopolitics.
Old man shaking fist at technology.
That's why I have a blog.
Yeah, right.
Slyflourish.com.
I've been podcasting for 37 years. No, it hasn't quite been that long.
I don't think it's been 37 years. My Apple 2C.
Yeah, right.
Would you like to hear about my news group?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you're right.
My dad probably has a 37-year-old podcast. It's called a cassette tape.
Yeah, yeah.
And he has a recording of one of his seminars on a cassette tape. I still have it.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Probably lasts longer than ours.
No, we've been recording the Tome Show for a long time, but
it's true. Yeah.
So, but yeah, no, it would have been the early 2000s ish. It was definitely after I graduated college, but not too long after I graduated college.
Did you have the podcast during third edition days?
Oh yeah.
Oh really? Okay. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
I had thought about it back in third edition a bunch.
Did you know Twitter was originally a podcast app?
I did not know that.
It is. It was originally designed to be a podcast app, and then Apple said, "Hey, we're going to have our own." And then they're like, "Well, I guess we should do something else," and decided to turn it into a messaging app instead.
Okay.
But its original intent was to do podcasting. Yeah.
Huh. Interesting. Anyway, we are all over the place, and my heart out is in minutes. So let's go ahead and just call this episode over. Like I said, we're at the Tome Show, and we talked about all of our socials and then got off on a rant. So why don't we just say goodbye, guys.
Goodbye, guys.